Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Corinne Alisa and her book, Journey of the Prophets, The Unabridged Life of Joshua, Son of Joseph from Galilee. This is a first-person account through Joshua, or Jesus, as many people know him, about his life as given to Corinne. And as such, it's very, really a great story about what it was like to be thrust into a world with many political challenges, which we've heard existed at that time. And also, as Joshua was so different in terms, and we'll speak about this more, in terms of his, probably his genetics and his mission was so different than the children around him, how he adjusted to that. And then, of course, the controversial end of his life, what really happened, and I think that this book describes it very well. Thanks, Corinne, for joining us.
Well, thank you, Dr. Kolb, for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here today.
So, would you give us a little bit of information about your story and how you came to understand that you were going to tell this story?
Sure. It's a big part of my life, as you can imagine. This book is huge in my life. I've been talking with Yeshua, as his Hebrew name is pronounced. Mm-hmm. I've been talking with him since I was a child. I had a very, very difficult childhood. Abuse was rampant on my being, and he would come and sit by my bed and help me, comfort me, and talk to me about the amazing life that I was going to have, the adventures that I would have when I grew up. And basically, he helped me stay afloat and keep myself upright with integrity and moving forward in my life without the mental of problems that would come along with abuse overtaking me.
Right.
So I'm very, very grateful for that. But what happened when I was an adult, I became a spiritual advisor, medical intuitive, and Yeshua started asking me about 30 years ago if I would be willing to write his life from his point of view. And at that time, I was very, very frightened of it. It mm-hmm. scared me. I remember in the 80s when Salman Rushdie, there was a fatwa put on his life, and he mm-hmm. had to go into hiding just because he wrote
right,
about
yeah.
a religious figure.
Right.
And so it's like, no, I don't think I'm going to do that. It was very fearful, just the idea.
Wow, absolutely. You do not challenge the belief systems of certain more politically ingrained areas without a potential threat to your life. That's very true. Even
yes.
in these times, it's very true.
Yes, indeed. However, I'm not afraid of that any longer. In 2010, I had a life-threatening illness that put me mm-hmm. in the emergency room, and they said, you have to have surgery right away or you're going to die. And I said, okay, mm-hmm. let's do it. And I came through the surgery just fine, but I became non-responsive. I died in the recovery room.
Mm-hmm.
And through that experience, I came back to life without any feeling of joy at being here. I was like, why did I come back? As you've probably heard many people express when they have a near-death experience, that they didn't want to come back. They wanted to stay there.
No, most don't.
Right.
Well, you came back because you weren't finished with your mission, I would imagine.
That's exactly true. Exactly
right.
True. It was about 2 weeks after I came back to life, and Yeshua leaned in and he said to me, maybe now you would consider creating this book, writing this book with me. And it landed in me so finely, so mm-hmm. beautifully. It filled me with joy in a way that that suggestion never had in my life.
Right, yeah.
And
well, you were ready.
Yeah,
you
journey.
Were ready too.
I was.
I have a short story to tell about his sense of humor.
He has
a fabulous sense of humor, and this is a funny story. As I told you, a member of my meditation group has a relationship with him similar to yours, and it was since childhood, or as early as he can remember, that he was his main guide and is always there for him, just similar to what you said. And this particular individual is homosexual, and he was raised in the, he's about my age, so he was raised in a time where being homosexual was not socially acceptable. You know, like in high school, nobody ever said they were homosexual when I went to high school. So, and the same with him. So he was, like, mortified because he was raised in a religious family and being homosexual meant you were going to hell. So he was very depressed about being homosexual, and he asked to die many times, like, not unlike you did with the abuse. And so one day after high school, he found himself working in, like, 110 degrees temperature in a factory that dyed yarn. So he was working with these chemicals and dyeing yarn, and he finally said to Jesus, he said, why am I here? And Jesus said, well, you told me you wanted to die.
Oh, yes.
Now that is
him
some of Jesus' sense of humor, okay?
I love that story.
Isn't that a great story?
It really is.
So the point is that what Jesus told me in session is that being famous and being a spiritual leader and being a master, as Jesus was and so well known, allows him the opportunity to guide a large number of people because they know about him. You see what I mean? So, you know, that is really helpful when you're in spirit, is to be, like, well-known. Because if you're not well-known, I mean, there's been many prophets, masters, and that we really know nothing about because historically they didn't make it into the limelight. But basically, I think a lot of religion would teach, the Christian religion would teach, that you just need to ask for Jesus to help you, and he will. And then I think that's the important point of what, you know, he was saying when he said that allowed him to help a lot of people. So that spiritual help is available, but a lot of times you do have to ask for it.
Oh, absolutely, you have to ask for it. The masters are bound by our wishes. They can't step in and help us if we don't give permission, and that's what the asking for help does. It gives them permission to help us, and they will only help us to the extent that we want it. So if we want just a little bit of help, we'll get a little bit of help. We want a lot of help, we'll get a lot of help.
Well, let's start a little bit at the beginning of the story. And when he was, tell us a little bit about his family and especially his relationship to his brother James, because it seems to me that James provided an awful lot of opportunity for Jesus to learn, you know, proper conduct and a lot of spiritual lessons, which was just really a wonderful part of the story. It's nothing like having a little brother like James, huh?
Indeed. Well, we should all be so lucky, yes?
Yeah.
James was his best friend growing up. James was 2 years younger than Yeshua. And Yeshua had to learn the same lessons that everybody else has to learn when they're growing up. He was human. And there's one really great story in Journey of a Prophet that Yeshua James did something to Yeshua at the creek during morning baptism, and really bothered him until he pitched a fit. Yeshua pitched a fit in the creek and got caught by Mary, who chastised him, and he felt quite a bit of revenge toward James. He said, I'm going to get back at James for not treating me right, treating me well, mm-hmm. getting me into trouble with mom. So he thought about it and finally came up with an idea. James used to like to take care of animals who were hurt or needed to be nursed in some fashion before they were put out into the wild. He really loved to take care of mice and squirrels and chipmunks and birds and all that kind of wildlife that was around the farm. Yeshua stole the bird and put it in a bag and put that bag in one of the barns. So thinking that the bird would just stay there in the bag. But later on, when James found that his bird that he had been nursing was missing, Yeshua sort of like decided that, you know, I shouldn't have had all of this feelings of revenge. I'm hurting my brother, who's this person that I love and care for. And he really viscerally felt the feeling of the revenge. So he says, okay, let's go find the bird. I know exactly where the bird is. But when they got to the barn, the bird in the bag was no longer there. They went searching for it and found it finally behind the barn. The bird had been killed and was being eaten by one of the local cats. And,
well, the sense of smell doesn't, you know, the cat can smell the bird, even if the
exactly.
bird's in the bag.
And yeah. Yeshua says, well, you know, he realized he left the bird out like a lamb at the slaughter.
Right.
Just sitting there waiting to be eaten by the cat.
Yeah.
And it filled him with grief and mm-hmm. remorse that he had done this. He had taken the life of the bird for no reason. He had hurt
right.
his brother
yeah.
for no reason. It's a lovely story in the book. Certainly in Journey of a Prophet, the story is a little more eloquent mm-hmm. than I just gave it to you. But it's indicative of the things that he had to learn.
Yeah.
He had skills, talents mm-hmm. from his extraordinary genetics that some of the other children, most of the other children, did not have. So he
right.
had a stronger will than other children, and he had to learn how to not take over the will of others and make things happen just because
mm-hmm.
he could.
Yeah, that's a very important lesson, because you can even kill inadvertently if you get angry at somebody.
Yes.
That can happen. And there's a story in Ireland. Joseph provided 10 to the Roman army, so he, and a lot of the 10 came from Ireland, and there's stories in Ireland of, because he took Joseph there, Jesus there with him one time, and Jesus got mad at a boy in Ireland, and the boy fell dead, and then the people were complaining to Joseph of the, you know, of this, and that was one of the things that prompted getting Jesus into the mystery schools, which are indicated in your book, the universities and
yes.
everything that he went to, and it's actually historical. There's stuff in Ireland about it. My friend Tricia McCannon wrote a book about Jesus's first years at Jesus's request. Actually, he appeared to her and asked her to write this book, and she's been on the radio show. But it chronicles the time between about age 8 and the time he started his mission. And includes India, Ireland, and Egypt in terms of what the training was, you know, which was extensive,
mm-hmm.
as you know.
Mm-hmm. Very, so, yes.
Yeah, so he's been busy getting his story out. But Tricia did it with historical references, a huge number of historical references that weren't previously ever put together. So
oh, that's
that was
lovely.
That was the important. I mean, this is yours is channeled material, but hers was, you know, was putting it with history, which of course has a lot more influence on academic people studying this. which happens, yes. You know. Got their attention on that. So you want to tell a little bit about what when Jesus left home and why he had to go by himself, and what that led to in terms of his studies and how that contributed to his mission.
Oh, sure. In the book Journey of a Prophet, we chronicle his journey to India and went to a school, university at Kapilavastu, which is in Nepal. At the time was in, you know, the general Indus. And so Yeshua went to university there, ended up becoming a teacher there after his studies. But they mm-hmm. had a secret library of knowledge that he was finally given access to, and he read texts that probably don't exist any longer, but chronicled mm-hmm. texts by Gautama Buddha and many other masters who lived before him. And that created in him a sense of the largeness of life and this and living that mm-hmm. really bolstered him into his mission. After he left the university at Kapilavastu and moved forward from there into Tibet, into the mm-hmm. Himalayas, he ended up studying at a place called the Temple of Man, which is where he really took on his ability to be a master of the earth plane. He mm-hmm. became what his creator said was the very embodiment of love, which, right. as we all know, is the core message of Yeshua's work, right. that yeah. love is the greatest power in the universe, mm-hmm. and it transcends. It transcends everything, even fear. Fear, he puts love and fear on two ends of the spectrum. Love mm-hmm. is the greatest power. Fear is the second greatest power. You can only hold on to one at a time. And right. They will permeate your life if you hold on to one. So if you hold on to love, it will eschew fear for you. Mm-hmm. You hold on to fear, unfortunately, it will eschew love. And so we have that as humans, we have that basic choice to make. Which are we going to allow to permeate our life, love mm-hmm. or fear? And this is where he really learned how to take that on and be that in a very deep way. Certainly facilitated his mission throughout the rest of his earthly days.
I want to back up for a minute, if I could. Mm-hmm. He had to also grapple with this in his own personal life. He had several assassination attempts when he was young.
Yes.
Do you want to recount the one when he was with Joseph and then the one when he was on his way to India?
Sure.
Just a little bit to have people understand, just like the Dalai Lama and probably most of the great masters who've come here, there are forces opposing their continued existence on Earth that usually take the form of assassination attempts. And then how he was able to not fall victim to any of these attempts.
Sure. The first one that's chronicled in Journey of a Prophet is the one in Egypt. He went with Joseph on a business trip to Egypt when he was 8 or 9, I believe mm-hmm. 8. And at that time, they were in Memphis as Joseph was going to visit some business contacts, and mm-hmm. they ran into a woman called Salome, who was a member of the Council of Sophia. Now, the Council of Sophia is still alive to this day, although most people have never heard of them, but they were extremely active back then, during mm-hmm. Yeshua's time. There were a group of women priestesses who ran many of the temples and spiritual institutions in Europe and the Mediterranean and in Africa at that time. He ran into Salome, who was a member of this Council of Sophia, and Joseph had encountered her before when he was at the monastery at Carmel and meeting Mary, Yeshua's mother, for the first time. Salome had an instrumental role in trying to thwart Mary becoming the woman she would be and had to give birth to Yeshua.
Yeah.
And at that time in Egypt, Salome arranged to poison Yeshua, and he became very, very ill. They nursed him through that illness, and he didn't die, but I believe it was only probably at the, you know, the good fortune of his extended genetics that kept him alive. I imagine he would have died had he not had a stronger constitution than most other people.
Yeah.
He laid in bed for almost two weeks, pretty much unable to move, talk, do anything. So that was the first one that's chronicled in the book. The second one is on his way to Kapilavastu, to the university in India. He was followed by a group of beings from Africa, a young man named Madib and his family who had been contracted to assassinate Yeshua.
Right.
And he had to go through an entire subterfuge at the behest of his own guides. Yeshua had guides that he listened to and interacted with. And at the behest of those guides, they talked him through a subterfuge where he had to pretend he was ill and find his way past the assassins to get to university. Unfortunately, these assassins knew he was going to the university, so they were able to catch up with him again later. And it was only the good fortune that the authorities of the time believed him, that there was somebody out to assassinate him, that they were able to catch the assassins before they did the deed.
So just to mention, because the listeners may not be aware that the family of Jesus is like descended from the house of David, of course, but they were royalty, and also were heavily influenced by the Essenes, and his mother, his grandmother came from Ireland, and she was married to a gentleman that kind of abused her, and when he died, she took Mary to the Essene portion of, you know, that, I guess it was in Israel, or I don't know what it was called then, but it was there that Mary was raised, and then that led to the Essenes being involved in a lot of the planning of the genetics of how Jesus would come to be, and that was very much guided as well, you know, in terms of who the mother would be, who the father would be, and how the Mary would get pregnant, and everything. So that was not like a normal pregnancy, but it was planned well in advance.
Very much so. Yeah,
very much so. Right.
Yes. The Essene believed that they would be the people who brought what they called the great teacher back to this world. And so Yeshua, being the embodiment of the great teacher, they put a lot of energy into selecting the mother and selecting the father. And there's a story, backstory, that in a book I might publish at some point, about Joseph meeting Mary. At first, he was Joseph had left his family, his children, his wife, who beloved wife, had died. His children were already adults and had, you know, wives, children of their own. Joseph went into the monastery there, and that's where he met Mary. And his first charge after he met Mary was to keep her from harm, because there were assassins coming. Yeah. Once Mary was chosen, there were assassins after her as well.
This is a big story. You know, this
is it. Really is.
There's a lot of backstory to this, and also the age difference. Mary was, I believe, 14 when they met, and Joseph was in his 40s. Is that right?
Joseph was quite a bit older. I believe Joseph was in his 50s, perhaps.
Okay,
when they met.
Well, that could be true too if he had grown children. Yeah.
Yeah,
but
he was very much older.
So, yeah.
He was very much older. And Mary, I believe, was only 13 when she gave birth to Yeshua.
Really? Oh, my
goodness.
Well, she was very young.
She was very young, yes.
Yeah.
But it's what she came for. Mary was a very stalwart and a woman full of faith.
Right.
Very strong in her faith, and she believed that this was her mission. This is what she came on this earth to do.
Right.
And she stood by Yeshua all the way through the crucifixion with just stalwart faith.
Right.
An amazing woman.
And Joseph was amazing, too. I mean, I love the story and hear about Joseph. One of my personal guides is the oversoul of Joseph. So I've had a lot of comments while I'm reading the book from this person, because he was Joseph. And so I'm reading along, and he's, like, commenting, and it was really funny. Oversoul was Saint Germain, Christopher Columbus, Joseph, and most recently John Eric, who was an actor in Hollywood who was in the Voyagers, and he was also a male model. So I have pictures all over the place of John Eric, because he has gifted them to me, as a reminder that he's one of my guides. And so,
wonderful.
Yeah. So although I don't speak to Jesus on a daily basis like you do, I'm certainly part of the family.
Yes.
So many people living now had
incarnations at that time.
Right.
And
the genetics too. You have to remember that the genetics are what is carried forth, and we'll get to that a little bit later when we talk about, the genetics that survived Jesus, of his genetics, because that's very, very important. So I guess we were at the Indian school. What else did he learn there?
At the Indian school?
Yeah.
Well, he had his first encounter with human physical lust. He fell in love with a girl there named Saleya. And it was a very, very powerful experience for him. To be in lust with this young woman, she wasn't available to him. She was betrothed to another person, and so she was unavailable. But he didn't know that at the time when he fell in love with her. Mm-hmm. She was attending the university, and he was her tutor, and so that was one of his big experiences there. Being caught with her, kissing her at one point by her father, who took the whip to them both.
Yeah.
And that was a very powerful experience. When he talks about Saleya to me, he talks about her with great reverence. But it was not to be.
No.
It was to move on and fall in love with someone else later, much later.
Mm-hmm. Right. So what happened after that?
After Kapilavastu? Well, as I mentioned earlier in Journey of the Prophet, we chronicle him going to the Temple of Man, where he has his first ascension experience. He actually ascends out of his body and up, and has his first experience talking face-to-face with who he calls the Creator, his Creator.
Right.
And it's during that time that he decides to take on his mission The Creator gives him the opportunity to ascend and go on and go about his life. But he felt so connected to us,
mm-hmm.
so much a part of this world and a part of who we are in as humanity, that he couldn't do it. He chose to come back immediately,
mm-hmm.
back into his body and continue his mission.
Right.
And so when he left the Temple of Man, he actually went into another institution there, a bone martial temple, where he learned martial arts and many of the talents that he had when he came back to Judea many years later, to walk his mission there in Israel. He those talents were learned, many of them, at that bone martial temple.
And that would be like also the mental concentration and mental control, because that's
Absolutely.
Extremely important when you're at the level of a master. Because even,
Absolutely.
I mean, some of the masters don't speak at all, because the spoken word can become, you know, can manifest immediately. And that's the, you know, some of the masters, like Maribaba, didn't speak for 40 years. You know, it's
yes.
It's interesting. Different
yes.
challenges at that level than we might have at our level.
Absolutely. Well, one of the things he said is that, you know, time and space became resources for him, like we would think of wood or clay.
Right.
That he could, with mere thought, resculpt reality around
mm-hmm.
him.
Well, time and space are constructs that are, I guess, unique to the third dimension. You know,
yes.
they're not in eternity. So if they're unique to here and you're a master of this dimension, why wouldn't you be able to manipulate them? I mean,
exactly.
you would be able to, yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
some of his, he had first manipulated time when a friend of his was injured, and I think he was, what, a teenager at that time?
Yeah,
he did
a young man.
Inadvertently. Mm-hmm. I mean, he didn't do it without knowing. He did it out of an emergency.
He did. He did. It was at the family compound, what we call the family compound there in Galilee,
mm-hmm.
and he ran. The boy was at the bottom of a ditch with his name was Michael, and he had a broken leg, and Yeshua mm-hmm. became frightened for him, and James went off to go find people, but mm-hmm. in his anxiousness for Michael, Yeshua decided to go get people faster, and he just went. He went and got the men who could come and help him help Michael get out of
mm-hmm.
his hole, and back to Michael mm-hmm. faster than James was able to get to them in the first place. He just whoop,
right,
whoop.
And it was a little suspicious.
Very suspicious.
So he learned that these little tricks with time and space could lead to unwanted attention.
Absolutely.
You can't be too different here. I mean, honestly, you can't be too different here, because it frightens people, and those frightened people can harm you. I mean, that really
Absolutely.
Is what it comes down to. So
yeah,
Joseph,
right.
being the wise person he did, was counseling Jesus, you can't do that, you know.
Yep.
Even though your
yep.
intentions were good, you're going to draw attention to yourself.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. I mean, you don't want to do that publicly,
father.
You know.
Right. But then, and Yeshua listened to him. He was wise enough to know that his father was guiding him well, so he listened.
Right.
And he didn't use his ability to manipulate time again until an emergency much later on his way to university, where he got caught in a flash flood.
Right. And there weren't so many people around then.
No, there weren't. Just a few
it was
people
pretty
that
safe.
He was traveling with.
Yeah, right. Well, just
yeah.
a few people is okay, and they already know you're pretty special. So, yeah, it's the unknown people, the people that are fear-based, that will,
fear-based.
Like you said to us, will string you up for things that, being strung up on the cross. Not dying on the cross,
right.
but being strung up on the cross. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So,
And there,
okay,
were,
so,
there were, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say, there were many times when he was finally back in Judea and walking his path, walking his mission
mm-hmm.
of helping people change the way they think and the way they hold reality, people were really rough on him. There were many times when he recounted being grabbed by the crowds and pulled back into the crowds with people, you know, grabbing at him and pushing at him, and he had to oftentimes use his ability to completely disappear, to just disappear from
sight. You can't be a prophet in your hometown. That's something I think that he learned. and also the, you know, the play Jesus Christ Superstar, that part where everybody was always at him, you know, do this for me, do this for me, do this for me, that has to get old, you know, because he's trying to teach them to take care of themselves through spiritual development, and they just want him to fix everything in their lives, which, of course, they'll just recreate the problems because they're still at that level of consciousness. So it must have been fairly, just a hard, you know, a hard thing to accept that people really didn't want to, many people really didn't want spiritual development. They just wanted him to fix all their problems.
Yes. And I believe that's actually plagues him still. That's still true. How many people pray to him to fix their lives, but they're unwilling to take on the consciousness that they need, to do it themselves.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
So, now we're back at where he is ready to do his mission. Do you know how old he was at that time? Do you have any idea what how many years had passed before he came back?
Well, he was in earthly years 28 when he came back to Judea to reunite with his family, and that was urged that he come home and take up his position in the family as head of the David family, because his father Joseph was dying, and in fact did die before Yeshua got back. So he missed seeing Joseph again, which was a large pit for him, an emotional pit for him that he missed Joseph. Yeah. But when he got back, he was 28, but he was actually older than that, as time is so elusive and manipulated, and he spent many years in places where time did not register on the earth plane. Mm-hmm. So he was actually in his 30s before he got back to Judea.
And then what happened then?
Well, he brought back a burden with him. He brought an addiction with him. He took on a very earthly human affliction called addiction, and he brought that back with him. And so when he reunited with his family, James is an interesting man, and as we know him in history as being one of the, after the crucifixion, being the one of the most influential men in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. He became that. But at the time when he was younger and Yeshua came back to the family, he had a very judgmental attitude toward people. And he was very, very austere and did not, you know, back up just a little bit. The Essenes taught temperance, but they taught doing things with moderation. Moderation in all things. That was one of their things. So you don't
keeps you away from addiction.
It does.
There's a lot of different addictions. I mean, it's not just one thing. You know, there's all sorts of addictions.
Exactly. Yes. So James was very judgmental of Yeshua, that Yeshua had taken on this addiction. They actually told him to leave the family, and Yeshua had to go out on his own and figure out how to, you know, relieve himself of that addiction burden before he was able to come back and really take his place in the family.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's probably in divine order too.
Absolutely. You know, the way he talks about it with me is that it gave him a deep, deep understanding of the pitfalls of humanity that he wouldn't have had otherwise. He really needed to fall into that darkness to be able to really experience the light that he truly is.
I think compassion comes from having been there yourself.
Yes.
You know, it does.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So when he finally was able to get past his addiction and get back to the family, he took on the role of head of the David family with gusto. Mm-hmm. And he considered himself to be a prince. He could not call himself a king because Herod was king, and Herod was a puppet of the Romans.
But
and,
other people were calling him king of the Jews, right?
Absolutely.
That got him in trouble.
It did. It really did, yes.
It really did, yeah. Be careful what others say about you.
There was one man in particular, Caiaphas, who was at the head of the Sanhedrin, and Annas, who had been the head of the Sanhedrin before Caiaphas, and Caiaphas was Hannah's son-in-law. Mm-hmm. So it was just a continuation of their family being at the head of the Jewish Sanhedrin for years and years and years. And Caiaphas could not accept Yeshua. He really felt that Yeshua was his enemy out to usurp his rule, Yeshua never wanted to usurp anyone's rule. He didn't want to be the ruler of anyone.
Right.
So that
was more
bogus,
like a world teacher. He was a teacher and an example, and showed people the way to out of the suffering.
Yes, yes, as he still does, yes. Mm-hmm. So he took on that role, and it came down to a very difficult decision, as was recounted in the book. He had to make himself, he had to put himself in the line of fire and create his own execution.
Right.
So that he could live through it.
Right.
Otherwise, he had enough enemies that they were not going to allow him to live any longer if he didn't.
So tell us again a little bit about Judas, who also kind of got a bad rap in history.
Well, he got a very bad rap. Yes.
Didn't he?
Poor Judas.
Well, there's a book of Judas. You know that. There's a book of Judas that isn't in the Bible. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Judas was an amazing man. Judas really straddled the world of peace. As the Essenes called the way of peace, Yeshua was very big on the way of peace. Mm-hmm. And Judas straddled the world between the way of peace and the way of the zealot. He was a zealot. He was a very dynamic, Judas was a dynamic leader of rebels who wanted to start a war against Rome. And so Judas straddled that world between Yeshua's way of peace and that very violent world of the zealots with amazing dexterity. I find it just absolutely amazing, the things that that Judas did. But Judas was Yeshua's best friend.
Mm-hmm.
Best friend outside the immediate family. Of course, James was his you know, advisor and guide and all of that, and dear friend, brother. But Judas was his best friend, and he actually asked Judas if he would help him with this plot to mimic his own death.
Yep.
And
it
was a
great
act
so hard
of faith.
And later took his own life because he misunderstood things, you know.
He did. He thought, everyone thought Yeshua was dead. They put him in the shroud and put him in the tomb.
Yeah.
They thought he was dead, even though he was not. He had employed his wonderful skills that he had learned in the East to be able to lower his metabolism
to look like you're dead.
To look like you're dead.
And many other masters in the East have done this. I mean, we know it can be done.
Yeah. Yes, we've seen it. It's documented.
Yeah. But Jesus really was injured. I mean, even though he didn't die, he was seriously, seriously injured.
Seriously injured. Yeah. There's a a point in Journey of a Prophet that I urge all readers to steel themselves a little bit before they read it. This point where he recounts all of his injuries as he's laying
and
there
his
in
suffering.
The tomb,
my goodness,
trying to figure out what to do next.
Tell us a little bit about the resurrection, what in Christian terms, the resurrection, what that was and how he really did appear to people and what their responses were and what he ended up having to do because he couldn't really hang out in his home, you know, in his home anymore. He had to leave.
Right. Yeah.
It was too dangerous, even though he was dead.
Yeah.
Where people thought he was dead. Let's put it that way.
People thought he was dead, right. He wasn't. He actually lived, but he lived in a way that created an energetic likeness of him to be available, if you will. Yeshua is very clear. He said, I did not die. I have not died. I am still living.
Right.
He has been living. He is a 2,000-plus-year-old man who appears to be in his 30s when you see him.
Yeah, he certainly does appear to people. I have friends he's appeared to. I mean, they're not psychiatric. They're very
right,
sane.
Exactly.
he's,
you know, it's the most interesting thing.
It is.
Almost everyone knows what Yeshua looks like.
Yeah.
You close your eyes and you think about him. It's not the white man you see in European art. It's not the black man that you see in modern African and American art. It's and it's not a typical Arab or either.
No. He was Jewish, so he looks like a Jewish person from the Middle East.
He does.
I mean, that's,
he does.
Which is brown.
And everyone knows what he looks like.
Well, I was in meditation one day, and it was like in the 90s, the 1990s, and it was new to me, this channeling stuff. And Jesus came through another person, and I said to myself, this isn't Jesus. And then Jesus appeared in a vision right in front of me. I mean, his face. And I go, okay, you got me. This is you.
All right, it's you.
That was my first vision of Jesus. It was like, whoops, okay.
Yeah.
Sorry for that little doubt there. Like I said, he has a great sense of humor.
Oh, he really does. And he loves frogs. He loves frogs. For whatever reason, he loves frogs, and he often appears to be in a frog suit. And,
kind of
ribbit with googly eyes and to make me laugh. He's got a great sense of humor. You know, Mary Magdalene, who most people call her, Yeshua calls her Miriam, and she became his wife.
Right, and had a lot of children.
She had a lot to say about Yeshua and what and she's always extolling how he loved to laugh, he loved to dance, he loved to sing.
Yes.
He was a very jovial, loving, kind, effusive person.
Right.
The kind that
everybody
wants to meet.
And then the genetics. You talk about the genetics earlier in your book, but that many of us now have the genetics that came through the family of Christ. Of course, from the house of David originally. These are genetics that really were, in my understanding, Palladian they're off-world genetics as well.
They're off-world genetics, absolutely.
And they come through David, who loved to sing, dance, have sex with people that weren't his wife.
Yes.
those qualities are probably quite Palladian. But anyway, the things I think that we have in common, and you probably have this too, is that work and play are not two separate things. For Jesus, there was no work. You know, for us, there is no work. We play at everything we do.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, that's very Palladian.
Very Palladian, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, most
of the people, you say in your book, most of the people reading this book now probably have these genetics. And the gifts of the Spirit, which are outlined in Jesus' teachings, are genetic in nature. They really are.
Yes.
that you know, they come through the genetic lines.
Yeah, he
and
says
many people now are of this family. Yes,
absolutely. He says anything I have done, you can do, and that's literal. That's not figurative. That's literal. We do have this genetic line inside of us, and for many of us, we don't have it turned on. But it's easy to turn it on. It comes from intention and making life choices that will lead you toward the extension of your consciousness into the vibratory levels that can turn this genetics on in you. Yeshua is very clear. Almost everyone living today has this genetic strain inside them. You just need to intend it and turn it on.
Yeshua's recent messages to us have been about the ascension. And he says the ascension is very, very natural. It won't be something uncomfortable other than, you know, a little bit. You need to rest. You need to meditate. You need to follow your dietary instructions. But it's going to be very natural, and it's going to be very, we'll know more that we went through it in retrospect than when we're going through it. He also said it's like popping corn. He says, like, when corn pops, you know, a few go off first, then the majority go off, and then a few go off later. So not everybody will ascend at the same time. And then he also said that he had made a mistake. He thought that the ascension was imminent when he was in his mission. And he said that he thought that he had to do things very quickly, and he actually made some political mistakes that he said got him strung up. So he said, obviously, the ascension hasn't happened yet, and it's 2,000 years later, so but he says it's happening now. So I think that this is the reason that you've written your book. This is the reason why there's a time frame for all of us to understand that the ascension is now and that we need to get things in order in our spiritual house.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, one of the reasons you have your friend who's written a lovely book that I've heard of before, you mentioned it, that's really historically documented, et cetera, et cetera, which is wonderful. One of the things about this book is that when you read it, it's several of the readers have said it's like sitting on a warm couch with Yeshua sitting next to you and his arm
around
you.
Yeah.
While you're reading it, it gives
And it also, the thing that struck me was how he had to overcome the same things all of us have to overcome.
Yes.
Control of the physical, control of the emotional, and control of the mental. And he was lucky that he was able to do this because of the family he was born into, the, you know, the people around him, the education he was able to afford. And you know, he was born into a royal family who was very wealthy for that reason, because he needed to have all of these benefits in order to become who he was. You know, it's like you manifest what you need, because if you're supposed to be a doctor, but you can never get to medical school, it's kind of a wasted life, you know. I mean, you really do manifest what you need to do.
Right. They were quite wealthy. They were quite wealthy for the time. And Joseph was a very savvy businessman, and he passed that on to his children, his son and Yeshua's brother Jude took over the family business, and it provided plenty of resources for the family.
Right, right. So we're coming up on the end of our hour. Is there any contact information you would like to give?
Sure. I would love for people interested in the book to go to journeyofaprophet.com. That's journeyofaprophet.com. There's a contact page on at that website where you can send an email to me if you wish to do that. It's very easy to get me through the contact page. And there's information about the book. The site itself is going to become more robust over time. I'm going to have quizzes there. There's going to be a free preview of the book. It's not up and running quite yet, but the book is available at Amazon.com, so both here in the U.S. and in Europe. So I'm excited about that. But you can learn a lot at journeyofaprophet.com.
Well, great. Was there any inspirational words you would like to give our listening audience, or any other information about the book you would like to give?
Well, I would like to quote Yeshua, the Journey of a Prophet. In the book, there are about 200 quotes that are directly channeled from Yeshua or Miriam or James, some of the other people around him. Mm-hmm. But there are many that are direct quotes from him in the book, and one of them is this: I've seen the dazzling substance of the soul. It is replete with love and joy, passion and wisdom. We are so much grander than we believe. We are light born of pure love. And that's how he sees us.
Yeah, I can attest that the quotes in the book are really, really wonderful. And, you know, a lot of people understand that the Bible does not have everything that Jesus taught about, wrote about, or, you know, even was remembered about him. And this book fills in a lot of the gaps. I really recommend it to people. Well, we're at
the
end of our hour. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Kolb. It's been a joy to be with you. I've really, really enjoyed our discussion.
Great. Well, this is Dr. Susan Kolb. We've been interviewing Corinne Alicia on Journey of a Prophet. And please join us next week. We will be interviewing Dr. Love on Healing the Emotional Component. Thank you for joining us.